Welcome to Bill and Ted Watch Movies, a podcast in which we watch movies and then we talk about them. I'm Bill.
And I'm Ted. We're glad you're here. Let's watch movies.
And talk about them.
And talk about them. The Dario, sing it high, sing it low. Today's film is Victor Fleming's 1939 film, The Wizard of Oz, the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer adaptation of Frank L. Bloom's 1900 children's novel, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Not the first Oz film, but certainly the most iconic, setting the stage for an odd string of future Oz-related pop culture media in music, television, and film over roughly the last 80 years. MGM's The Wizard of Oz also played a role in cementing the future of color filmmaking with its embracing of the Technicolor color film process. With eye-popping colors, clever special and practical effects, and a slew of catchy earworm musical numbers, Wizard of Oz tells the story of Dorothy Gale, played by Judy Garland, a young Kansas farm girl who finds herself in a magical land of Oz, contending with the Wicked Witch of the West over a pair of ruby slippers when all she wants to do is get home to her family. It's a film about introspection, where characters learn that the inner qualities they desire are qualities they may already possess. It's also a film that pits the real against the surreal, a nearly lucid dreamscape that digs deep into the psyche of its viewer, vacillating between the amusing and the sinister. Bill, I already know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. Was this the first time you watched this film, and what did you think of it?
Oz never did give nothing to the Tin Man that he didn't already have.
There you go.
There you are. Yeah, I can't count the number of times I've watched this movie, because this was regular fare in our household. It occurred to me, Karen and I were watching it last night, we didn't realize that the big chunk of it was in color. That was kind of a surprise to me. Mm. But when I saw the credits rolling in the beginning, and it had, you know, color by Technicolor, which was a big deal back then, realized this thing was in color. And then we were wondering, why do we only know it in black and white? It's because our TVs were black and white.
Yes.
And we saw them on we saw the movie on television over and over and over and over and over. So this is iconic, to say the least. But it was a real treat to see it as it actually was, that is, in the sepia-toned black and white, when they're actually in real Kansas and in the land of Oz, that sort of, as you put it, eye-popping, somewhat surreal Andy Warhol color by Technicolor. Great movie. This movie is nostalgic for me. You know, it's mom's snickerdoodles. It's Christmas. It's, you know, it's home. And it is about home. You know, there's no place like home, right, Ted? And,
yes.
You know, and my wife's from Kansas, so we snicker every time we hear, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. You know, that was a line that I think we used when we landed at LAX when we moved here from the Midwest. But, the slippers. You and I, we saw the slippers at the Hollywood Museum. We saw in all their glory. Apparently, there were many pairs of these things, but there they were. It's sweet. It's sappy. It's memorable. The music, earworm is the wrong word for it. I'm still hearing that music today from our viewing yesterday. And I'm amazed at looking back how many of the tunes are memorable. We all know Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Yes.
That one is just ingrained in culture, and there have been some great covers of that, although Judy Garland rocks it like no tomorrow. But the other stuff, too, the Follow the Yellow Brick Road, and, you know, even what those guards were singing, that, you know, you remember it's just brilliant.
It's immensely quotable. In fact, we have a clip that just throws throws in some of those quotable quotes from the movie, and we'll just throw that in right now for fun, and
all
we'll
right.
keep talking.
Let's pop that on.
Ira Gulch, just because you own half the county doesn't mean you have the power to run the rest of us. For 23 years, I've been dying to tell you what I thought of you. And now, well, being a Christian woman, I can't say it.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. My, people come and go so quickly here. Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my.
That's a horse of a different color. Come on in.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
Meldy! Meldy!
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Yeah, very quotable. And like you were talking about, like it kind of being a holiday thing. It was on like every Thanksgiving from like 1955 or something until like 1992.
I think that's why I saw it so often. I think you hit on it. It was it was an annual Thanksgiving thing.
And
NBC put it on.
And Michelle, and as we were talking about it, she said, you know, like I watched it, like I saw bits and pieces of it like every year, but didn't actually watch the whole thing very often. This goes into that, like, what's that movie, A Christmas Story? It's another one like that, you know, like, hey, kid, you're going to shoot your eye out. Like, because it was on so often, or It's a Wonderful Life, people will pop in at certain points, watch part of it, and then, like, supper's ready, and then you have to, like, leave the TV set. So bits and pieces you might have seen over and over again. And she said that it took... Like, it wasn't until she was a teenager that she realized that the characters from the farm, the farmhands, were actually the same actors.
Oh, yeah.
As the Scarecrow and the Tin Man and the Lion. So that's kind of an interesting thing, too, because if you're only seeing bits and pieces of it, but it is immensely quotable, and people just, like, some of these lines people will say at the water cooler or, you know, like, you know, throw into conversation, you know, or uses illustrations or whatever, because it's because people are so familiar with it. It's been like almost 80 years that this film's been around.
We caught the same thing when we were watching it when they're in Kansas in black and white, and
right.
The characters that eventually become the three characters in Oz, you know, the Tin Man, the Lion, and the Scarecrow. They lack the same things. They lack courage. They lack smarts, wisdom, brains, and they lack heart. And they're referred to. So the whole thing is kind of tipped off in the early farm,
right.
farm scene. So once you know the story that well, that's when you start to pick up all the other stuff that goes with it. And it's clever. It's really well done.
It rewards repeat viewing.
Basically. It does. And you know, sure, the special effects are a little schlocky, but they're schlocky in a good way, because you realize this is in a very different era of filmmaking.
Well, we're talking 1939.
Yeah. Right?
Like, so, I mean, like, they're pushing the envelope. I mean, usually Hollywood is pushing the envelope, like, in the most creative and best filmmaking processes, they're pushing the envelope. But they were doing some things that were kind of over, like even the Technicolor stuff. Like with Technicolor, they had this Natalie Kelmus, who is the kind of ex-wife of the guy who invented Technicolor. But she was kind of part of the company anyways, and she had to be on the set for any Technicolor film. And the studio didn't own the camera. You rented the camera from Technicolor.
Oh, nice. So that ensures some money being made.
Yes, and they really guarded the process, because they didn't want other... There were other color processes that were kind of being played around with, but she didn't like the garish colors. She wanted more muted colors, and she was kind of tyrannical about, like, you know, test, you know, footage and like making sure things. So there were like, she also would then have been involved in the other Victor Fleming film that people know, which is the Gone with the Wind. Because he also did Gone with the Wind, which is another big color film, and she was also involved in that film as well. But she kind of like was on all of the sets of every movie that was a Technicolor film at the first like number of years of it to kind of make sure that the product in the end looked good. And so that was kind of part of the whole thing too, which is interesting. So they, all of the stuff you're talking about, like there's also like the... there's special effects, but there's also like practical effects, and most of the effects you see are practical. Like nowadays, they tend to use like if they could use digital fire instead of actual fire, they would probably, or if they could figure out a way to kind of get around it. So when the witch shows up and disappears, and there's the puff of like red smoke, and there's the flames, that's real fire, and it's like a practical effect trap door and stuff, and she got caught on fire, like, and they had to have a stand-in and stuff, like, because it had to be all timed just right for the camera.
Yeah, no, it's,
if you don't have it timed right,
this is live action, or stuff like when the witch melts, you know. We just kind of take that sort of thing for granted. You can pull that off with CGI and just like, you know, the whole Lord of the Rings thing. You know,
how much of that was actually
filmed, and how much of that happened inside a computer?
It's a combination of things. But like with this, like, and there are a lot of films now that rely very heavily on CGI. Like the Lord of the Rings ones still were kind of a mishmash, utilizing the best of all worlds, you know, at the time. But with this, I mean, they had to do, it was almost a little more like, we've talked about this before, where some films have this kind of stage quality, like it's a little more like a stage play.
It is stagey. You know, we've said this before, like Arsenic and Old Lace and some of the others. Was an adaptation of a stage play, but the acting is stage acting. And I think a musical will naturally go down that direction. Although I have to say that when we watched West Side Story, that actually worked into a movie better than I thought it was going to. That's really well done. But this looked like something that could easily, and I'm sure it has, easily be done on stage. It's set that way, it's framed that way, and the lines are delivered the way stage actors deliver lines.
And there was a history already. I mean, like, the thing with that Frank L. Baum is that, like, this book came out in 1900, so this is already, like, almost 40 years after it came out. So these were beloved stories, like, and he had written a whole pile of them because basically he failed at everything else he ever tried to do. And this was, like, the popular thing, and he had little kids saying, hey, please write more. And he was like, well, I guess if I want to keep making some money. So there were stage adaptations, there were some silent films, there was one in 1910, a silent film, there was a bunch of silent films, so like people were already fairly familiar with it. So that's kind of an interesting element to the whole thing too. And there had been stage productions, and so it's not so unusual that it would have that quality, because it is something that was already kind of in the DNA of The Wizard of Oz and all of the Oz novels and the way they were being presented.
Yeah, it's still, when you watch it, it's kind of a funny experience. First of all, it's on a smaller aspect ratio than I'm accustomed to.
Right, not widescreen.
So I've got this kind of square thing in the middle of my TV. But when you watch it, the heart of the movie is this epic quest. It's another sort of, you know, epic quest, you know, framed story, right?
Yes.
And you're following this yellow brick road to this mythical Emerald City and the whole thing. But it's the viewpoint is so compressed and narrow, it kind of lacks the epicness of it. I think I was trying to figure out why you wanted to watch this right after the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and because it was very jarring, because that's so huge in its scope and this is so tiny.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, it felt cramped, the whole thing really feels like, man, this is kind of really, but like a stage, you know, on stage you have to create the illusion of expansiveness.
Sure.
You can't actually do do, you can't go to New Zealand and do it that way.
No. And like when she goes up the yellow brick road and then she has to stop and turn around and wave to the Munchkins because she can't keep going. There's it's a wall.
Right. Yeah. This road ends at about 5 feet. So
yeah.
So we're going to have to how old was Judy Garland when she did this? Do you know?
Yeah, she was like 15, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She was, she struck me as being old. She sang like that at 15?
Well, this is why she got the job. So basically, like, they had originally thought of getting Shirley Temple.
Uh-huh.
But they couldn't get her out of her contract with a different company, right? Like, so there's, I don't remember which one, but MGM couldn't get her. So then they needed to find somebody. And Judy Garland had already been like part of a kind of a vaudeville singing, dancing family thing for a number of years. And she was starting to get well known. She was already kind of connected with MGM, was on contract. But they, you know, they called her, I think the studio head at the time called her his little hunchback. So she, like, which is terrible. And also said, you have to lose 15 pounds play the part. And like, so she was on uppers and downers and she could smoke and, you know, whatever. But this is not good for a 15-year-old. And, you know, there's other things. Like, so already by this point, like, the die was being cast as to where Judy Garland's life was going to go.
Yeah, but it's no yellow brick road for her.
No. So, but she had this big voice, and that's why.
Boy, she did.
She, and you know, the other thing that you know, in looking at all of this in preparation for today, the thing is that Over the Rainbow song almost got cut out of the film.
Because
they thought that it slowed it all down much. And so there was a point where like people would like they said, "Well, I'm going to quit if you don't put it in," and like all. And so it finally ended up getting in. And the thing about it is, I remember I'd seen it all piles of times on TV and like along the way, and rented it probably a bunch of times back in the day. And when I was in college and I was going to art school, the Repertory Theater Wormwoods had played it. So I went and actually saw it in the theater, which was great. And one of the most memorable parts of that was watching that Over the Rainbow, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, being sung on the big screen, and like Judy Garland, larger than life, singing it up there. Was just like a huge thing. And I think maybe there was that song has a kind of a place in people's hearts, I think, for a number of different reasons. And we have a clip that kind of showcases that.
I belong to a special tribe of what used to be called troubadours. Sometimes they were called minstrels. Now we're called songwriters. We work for, in our songs, a sort of a better world, a rainbow world. Now, my generation, unfortunately, never succeeded in creating that rainbow world, so we can't hand it down to you. But we could hand down our songs.
Really do come true.
You had to do that. Izzy.
Yeah.
This is the best cover ever.
Oh, it's really great, yeah.
Oh, why can't I?
So I don't know, like
that's a 15-year-old singing that.
Yeah.
Oh man. I mean, that's a throaty alto with timbre that you don't normally get in a 15-year-old voice.
Well, she is a smoker.
That helps.
Actually, her costume had a little pocket in it, and like some women are like,
that's just brutal.
Pockets in a dress. Oh my goodness, that's the best
cigarettes.
Thing. It's for her cigarettes for the smoke breaks. So I don't know, Ted.
That is so rough.
Yeah, I don't know how many times, like the number of times that it's been covered, is just immense.
It's probably the most covered song.
Oh sure. You had Judy Garland, obviously, bookending that, but then Frank Sinatra, Willie Nelson, there was some death metal thing, there was this disco mecco thing, so throw all that stuff together plus any number of whatever else you might find, but it has legs. And Yip Harburg is the name of the guy who is one of the co-writers, and he's the guy introducing it at the beginning. I found a little clip of him talking about the song. So he knows that it has that this is something that's going to be passed down. Like sometimes songwriters write something and they know that it's going to be around for a while, and there's this this is the melancholic core of the film, right? Like, and because it is this vacillation between like sugary sweet and it's brimstone and treacle, right? Like there's a little bit of everything going on here, but there's this melancholic angle, like wishing things would be different. I looked at the actual book. I revisited the book that it's based on, and they describe Kansas as gray. Everything is, there's no color, that the sun has beat all the color out of it, that the sun has beat the color out of the painting on the house, like it's beat the color out of the grass in the fields, and the everything has this gray quality to it, and that's right out of the book. So this idea of having these sepia tones bookending the film, or that's the way it started. It's not just a clever trick, it's also indicative of the book itself. It's a way of pulling something out of the book and bringing it into the film. So you go from the melancholic, the beat out, like just dry looking, colorless world into this bright, colorful place, right?
Yeah, I think my wife from Kansas would take umbrage at that. It's a very lovely state with some sublime Midwestern scenery, but
I don't even know if Frank Elbaum had ever been to Kansas.
No,
like, you know what I mean?
It's not great. But here's the point. Here's this, as you were talking, I was kind of thinking about the song and thinking about the movie that's framed in black and white, and then in its core is this very interesting technicolor, almost surreal. A little Dale Chihuly going on there. You ever see the glass sculptures of Dale Chihuly?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's what we thought of when we were in Munchkinland. It's a Dale Chihuly. Yeah, that's where he got the idea for that. But anyway, and I think a lot of people got a lot of ideas from this movie, and we can go on to that later. But the rainbow thing. See, the rainbow is colorful, and Kansas is drab and sepia tone for Dorothy, and she's a 15-year-old. She wants to get away from home, and she's persecuted by this witchy. A woman down the street who has it in for her dog and whatnot, and so she's wistfully thinking of this idyllic place, this place beyond the rainbow, where everything is just perfect and pretty and wonderful. But at the end of the movie, there's no place like home. See, that wistfulness is redirected, having gone to the colorful place, she's homesick. She wants to go home. That's all she wants. And so you loop back on the film, and the most comforting, the most safe, the place where she wants to be the most is the sepia-toned place of Kansas, and it kind of maybe tells the truth of the utopia of that somewhere over the rainbow.
And here's the interesting part too, is that like sepia tone now is sentimental.
Oh, very. It was then. Sepia toning is how you preserve a black and white photograph from fading.
Right. And it creates this it's very sentimental kind of a
very much warm.
Yes.
You know, it's not that harsh blue black that you get with like an Ansel Adams print, you know.
Right, right.
But sepia tone is very warm, nostalgic. It looks old even when it's new.
Right, exactly. And sometimes that's on purpose, like used on purpose to illustrate this kind of idea. So,
see, I think this is a fundamental human need. And I think we're experiencing that today in this COVID era where we're all locked in at home and we want to go somewhere over the rainbow, is that we have a longing for place. And I think we talked about this with Lord of the Rings and the Shire and, you know, all of this, but with this longing for place. And I think this is a deep longing. This is the longing for God and for heaven and for an eternal place. You know, like the Apostle Paul says, we just live in a tent. We don't have a permanent dwelling. We long for an eternal dwelling. And so the song, I think, pushes on that. There's like what I would call a spiritual nostalgia that's in everybody, you know, so that the home that we have, whether you're a 15-year-old or a 60-year-old, the home that we have, it doesn't quite live up to that notion of that there's a place, there's some other place, you know, that is everything that I love and more.
And even for people who are like completely secular, let's say, and aren't in very close contact with that part of themselves, that longing, they still long. Like if you're listening to this in 2021, or you know, whenever you're listening to it, 2021, like people are longing for to get over the rainbow and out of wherever they are. Like often cases, right? Like I don't know how people are dealing with it. And where do you go on vacation if you live in Hawaii? I don't know. But anyways, so maybe to Kansas. So the other thing too with Dorothy is that while Judy Garland is 15 years old or so, she's playing younger, so they had to like strap everything, you know, down and like make herself seem like a younger person.
I that's why I asked the age question, because I noticed that it's like they really struggled to make her look younger than she was. But 15 is pretty close though, but she was a mature 15, let's just say that.
Let's say and that's why they kind of like had originally been thinking of Shirley Temple. Shirley Temple is like extraordinarily like popular at the time,
but she is younger. That didn't happen. This would not be the same movie.
She couldn't do the vocals, like they couldn't get the vocal range out of her.
The hair would be wrong.
Well, there's that too. But originally they didn't want to go with this hair either. Like
the pigtails ended up doing it, man. It's the look. It's the Dorothy look, man. Perfect.
But I mean, like getting back to like her natural hair color, or closer to her natural hair color.
You know, this illustrates the fact that you cannot intentionally make an icon. And I'm not talking about, you know, orthodoxy and that, but I'm talking about just an iconic film. I think it happens or it doesn't happen, but you can't intentionally set it. In fact, if you intentionally try to set out and do it, you won't. I think you just do the film you're given to do, and it happens or it doesn't. It's like something that comes along at just the right time, just the right place. You know, when did this come out? This came out in the middle of World War II.
1939.
You know, talk about somewhere over the rainbow. Talking about looking beyond, you know, what you've got in front of you. That kind of thing.
Well, also, you're coming, like you have the Depression, right?
Yeah.
Like, so there's a lot of things like these drifters that are like, you know, the farmhands. They come across as like, you know, hobos that have gotten jobs like on a farm as a farmhand. Like they you know, like there's this kind of, there's an undercurrent of Depression era of stuff all over the place.
Oh, very much so.
Fingerprints are all over it.
The house is Depression era.
And wanting to, you know, get out of that Depression era life and the money and all the rest of it, and like counting your chickens and all of these things that are right in there. Shifting gears a little bit, let's go to the Munchkins.
Oh, the Munchkins. All right.
There are a number of, you know, urban legends and myths and stuff about all of this stuff. But, you know, we have a little clip of Judy Garland talking about the Munchkins, and then also some of the actual Munchkins later in their life, you know, talking a little bit about some of that stuff about like them working on the film.
Well, what about the munchkins?
Yeah, how about the munchkins.
What the munchkins?
Well, they were.
They're little dwarfs.
Tiny.
Yeah. Were they little kids or were they little men?
They were drunks.
They were little drunks? What did they do? What the dwarfs do?
Well, one of them, who was about 40, a gentleman asked me for dinner, and I couldn't say, I don't want to go out. I can't because you're a midget. I just said, no, my mother wouldn't fight him. Come on, bring your mom, too, you know.
Mike and I did get drunk and make a lot of noise, you know, and fight. Charlie Ludwig, he was quite elderly. He wanted to go to bed. He was tired, see? So because he was tired, so they got mad at him and tried to get him drunk, and he didn't want to drink. And so they took him, and they had him partly drinking, you know, but he tried not to drink too much. Anyway, when he went to the lavatory, he lost his balance, fell head first in the toilet bowl, you know. So all of a sudden he started, help, you know. Mr. Sinner says, what in the heck is all that noise? So they both went in there, and here poor Charlie Ludwig is head first on. And they got him out. The poor guy was black and blue. So Mr. Singer says, I'm going to take him over to the house and keep him with us for a while until I get those drunks straightened out in there. And what Charlie Kelly did one night, he drug his wife in the lobby by her hair from one end of the place to the other. And that's when the owner of the hotel called up and told him, he says, you either come over here and straighten these people out, or they'll have to move one or the other.
Nobody had too much to drink because we didn't drink in those days. You had to start early and you had to leave late. And a lot of us did overtime. The rumors that really used to upset me was that there was troubles on the set. At no time was there any difficulty that Victor Fleming or anybody had on the set with any of the little people. As you would say, that might have been a result of previous night's activities.
Well, it's the greatest thing. I only had about, I don't know, 60 seconds on the screen, but I told them I was Buster Brown, Little Oscar, the Andy Williams. They said, then when I tell them I was in The Wizard of Oz, you were in The Wizard of Oz? Forget everything else. That's it. So that's how important this picture is. It dwarfs everything I've ever done. And even though it was the first thing I've done.
No pun intended.
No. It's very sincerely said. So, yeah, I mean, like, there were all sorts of rumors that it was a lot of shenanigans, right? And the thing that is that they gathered all, like, the qualifications was you had to be a little
sure.
person. But that didn't mean you all had to come from the same socioeconomical background or from the same walk of life or lifestyle or whatever. So you get all of these people together, and it's like a convention of little people, and when they're not filming, they're living at this hotel together, and most of them are good, you know, easygoing, you know, straightforward type people, and then there's a couple of them in the mix that are like they've got crazy domestic problems going on, and they're like,
look, it's a convention, okay?
Oh, so. Yeah. So, like, and there's like, yeah, some of them were heavy drinkers, and some of them didn't want to be, and all of the rest of that, right? So it was a kind of a mixed bag of stuff, you know? So, which is very, very interesting.
I'm having a Time Bandits flashback, even as we speak there.
Yes.
So funny. I'm not sure you could make a movie like that today. You have to be much more sensitive toward the vertically challenged.
Well, you know, it was
this is just great. I love how he's known for The Wizard of Oz. You were in The Wizard of Oz, you know. You could,
yeah.
He could have been in anything, but The Wizard of Oz, that's the clincher right there.
See, that's the clincher.
That's what an iconic movie is about.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a very interesting thing, all of that. And they speak very, like, some of them were talking, like, I watched this whole documentary about it and, you know, interviewing them, and they were talking about things like...
There's,
you know,
a documentary on the Munchkins?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
And this is...
Only you, Ted. Only you.
Yeah, it's called Follow the Yellow Brick Road,
oh,
I think.
Oh, cool. So I may have to watch that.
Yeah, well, I'll send you a link. So but they were talking about how, like, before this movie came out, they were largely just ignored, you know, in society.
Small and people?
That this kind of actually helped a lot, like, in terms of just, like, their general self-esteem, because it's not a small part of the movie. It goes on for quite a while.
It is, longer than I thought.
Yeah.
Or remembered. You know, it makes me wonder that the hotel manager, that might have been, had they been average-sized people, he might not have been as upset by the shenanigans as they were small people.
Well, yes. Yeah. And, you know, there's actually, if people are interested, there's a movie from 1981 called Under the Rainbow, which is Chevy Chase and Carrie Fisher. And it's a kind of a sort of a docudrama comedy about this aspect of the Wizard of Oz.
Ah, okay.
So that's something that if people want to go further down the rabbit hole or past the rainbow or under the rainbow or whatever, they can dig more into that. You know,
you have a really dark side, don't you, Ted? There's a darkness. I'm feeling it. You know, there's even a movie like the Wizard of Oz. You know, you root around for the darkness. You find it. You know,
so you don't have to root very hard, because, like, there's even an urban legend that one of them had hung themselves. And it was in the background that you could see far off, but it isn't that. It was there was a bunch of birds that it just had out, like, in the sets, and it was, like, I guess a heron or some sort of, like, something like that was in a tree, but far enough away that you couldn't tell one way or the other, and some blue heron or something. Yeah. Did you see the toucan at one point? There was, like,
I saw the toucan. Yeah,
yeah. So they had, like, ducks and other things, like, you know, kind of in the sets, but that was one of the things. And another thing too is, like, one of the Munchkins had, like, actual, like, two pistols, and that was to protect his wife.
Oh, okay.
And the director had to say, "I like you have to, like, get rid of those guns.
You can't
just be." Did you notice, though, that the Scarecrow actually has a gun? That's
I did not.
He's carrying a revolver.
Is
like
he?
When they go to the castle, he's got a revolver. It's just something else. Like, it's funny.
It's part of the getup. So it's
part of the getup. So there are some kind of, like, weird things just in general.
Well, it rewards the careful viewer. There's a little something for everybody in there.
It does. It does.
You know, I was thinking back to childhood and seeing this movie repeatedly at Thanksgiving, and I was reminded there are certain parts of it that I did not like as a child. I did not like the monkey people.
The flying monkeys.
The flying monkeys really bothered me. I didn't like the Oz illusion. And I remember being very happy when Oz is exposed as just being the man behind the curtain kind of thing.
Right.
The monkey people really bothered me. And that whole dark scene where, you know, that kind of reminded me of Mordor, didn't it? You know, the Dark Tower and Dorothy's held captive by the witch and everything.
Yeah.
But the dark scenes in there as a child really bothered me. But there was enough. The movie is lighthearted enough, and it gives you resolution that in the end it was okay. But there were a few looking away moments when I was a kid.
Oh yeah, and there's you're not alone with people.
I'm kind of a coward in that respect. You know.
Let's shift gears a little bit to just, like, this had, like we were talking about earlier, how it had an impact beyond the film itself, you know, reaching into popular culture, and you got remakes, you got sequels, you got all sorts of kind of crazy stuff. We have a grab bag of stuff. Now, this is going to be fun for the listener. So listen to see if you can identify what all of these things are. We'll go quickly through a list after we're done listening to it. Here we go.
Dark forest. All right, this is it. Just head on down that way. About 2-3 hours, you'll hit the Emerald City. Tell them I sent you. They'll take great care. Nice meeting you.
But I want to go with you.
What? On a witch hunt? No, you're just a little girl.
I'm not as delicate as I look.
That didn't hurt.
Oh, the world of Oz is a very funny place where everyone wears a funny, funny face.
All the streets are paved with gold,
and no one ever grows old.
In that funny land lives the Wizard of Oz.
Oh, no.
It's just a yellow brick.
No, Belina, you don't understand. This was the Yellow Brick Road.
Oh.
It leads to the Emerald City.
The wicked witch.
Oh.
Ding dong, the wicked witch is dead.
Oh,
after all those things you did to Snow White.
Distortion.
How about Hansel and Gretel?
We were framed.
And what about Dorothy and her little dog Tup-Tup in The Wizard of Oz?
She asked for it. And her little dog, too.
I hate to break this up, but I left my jacuzzi on fast forward.
Sailor.
The good witch.
Sailor Ripley, Luna loves you.
But I'm a robber and a manslaughterer. And I haven't had any parental guidance.
She's forgiven you all these things.
Is that Nicolas Cage?
That's Nicolas Cage. So, yeah, that's Nicolas.
Another brilliant mishmash by Ted. You've outdone yourself here. This is great work. You know, it makes me wonder, maybe Bill and Ted should be a video podcast, because people are missing out on this Ted creativity. I mean, I'm loving this. This is good.
Yeah, so that's Nicolas Cage, and that's from a movie called Wild at Heart by David Lynch. And the good witch is Cheryl Lee, who played Laura Palmer in the Twin Peaks TV show that was also started off by David Lynch. But he kind of uses the Wizard of Oz as a device in that film. And then we'll just go back to front. So then before that, you had Paul Lint Halloween special from 1976. He was the center square on the Hollywood squares for many, many years.
Yes, he was.
And then Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead by Barbara Streisand, 1966. The Wiz, this is a Sidney Lumet film.
Yep.
Diana Ross as Dorothy, Michael Jackson as the Scarecrow. And then Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, you noticed that.
Classic.
That's classic, 1973, Elton John. Return to Oz. This is the Walter Murch film. This is the follow-up. This is a sequel to Wizard of Oz. It's from 1985. And you talked about the dark moments that kind of like creeped you out as a kid or bothered you. This film is like takes that up and ramps it all the way up. It's it's a peculiar film. You may actually, we should watch it. It's very different.
Is that the one where the little girl finds the bricks? Is that
Yes, okay. That's the one, and her chicken is talking to
her. Yeah, her chicken's talking.
So this is when she returns back to Oz again, and this was actually done by Disney. So a weird thing is that
Disney has a big dark side.
It does. It's not that far under the surface, but MGM was trying to, like, with Wizard of Oz, was wanting to compete with Disney because of Snow White.
Okay.
Like, they'd had this big, huge hit with Snow White, and they said, we got to have something like that. And Wizard of Oz was the thing they decided to do. So, but in the end, Wizard of Oz is now the property of Disney, as many things are.
Yes, all of us will be one day.
Yes. And back in 1985, this was the sequel, Return to Oz. And then before that was this little cartoon that came out in 1 year, 1961, and it was just a 3-minute-long little cartoon called Tales of the Wizard of Oz. And then at the very beginning was from 2013, and that's Oz the Great and Powerful by Sam Raimi. And it had this little girl made of china, and that's actually out of the book, but it wasn't in the 1930 9 version of the film, this little girl, they go to an area that's all made of china. Like everybody's made, all the people are made of china and everything. So that's something they yanked out of that for that. Oz the Great and Powerful, which is a reimagining of the story. So yeah, I mean, it's all over the place. I mean, that's just some of it. Like it shows up in comedy routines. It permeates, you know.
Well, you can drop anything, you know, references to Scarecrow, Tin Man, and people instantly know it. It's not like that America song, you know, Oz didn't give nothing to the Tin Man. Everybody knows what that's from.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So I mean, it's really fun, and even like that Paul Lint Halloween special, that is actually Margaret Hamilton, the lady who plays the Wicked Witch of the West, later in her life reprising her role as the witch in that holiday special.
Yeah, she looked like her. I immediately saw that green makeup and all, but she looked and sounded like her. And when you have that much makeup on, you know, the character doesn't age. It's just all filled in.
And she's much older at that point. In fact, she had done quite a bit of television appearances and stuff. She was even on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood at one point, like talking about
not as believe. The witch, not, no.
Yeah, no, they're at to oh, talk about, because it was this frightening thing for little kids, like you were talking about. So she was there to kind of demystify,
to talk it down a little bit, and talk
the make-believe element of the acting, and that she herself was now a grandmother with grandkids, and people could kind of like little kids could just enjoy the make-believe element of it and not be so scared of the witch.
I had a little bit of a flashback to the witch, you know, because witches figure prominently in this.
Yes.
And some in a good way, some in a bad way, but you know, two of them meet untimely ends. One gets, I forgot about the one that got crushed by the house. You know, it's very early on, and then, you know, her sister is the other one that goes after Dorothy. But I was thinking about how different those witches are. Those, you know, they're scary, but they're not scary. They're scary to a little kid, but they're kind of funny to us. And there's the Witch in the Woods, from the movie, and that was a totally different experience, I would say.
Yes, but you know, as a kid, I remember when the Wicked Witch of the West goes to get her sister's shoes. And it's just the stocking feet, and then they kind of curl up and scoot underneath the house.
Yeah,
and that moment was always creepy.
Yes, that is a creepy moment. That's true.
It's almost like some kind of stop action kind of, like, I don't know what it is, but it's not normal. It's one of those surrealistic moments in the film.
And I don't know even what's intended there. Yeah, because nothing comes of that. Like, she never reappears. No. It's not like she's not really dead and now she reappears, but it's nothing ever comes of it. But it just lends a sort of surreal, creepy factor to it, which you can easily ignore or not, you know, as the case would be. It's otherwise in a very happy Munchkin land, which seems to be like a pretty happy place, right?
Well, they're certainly happy after the house drops on her.
Oh, yeah.
The import is that they had been under her thumb, and now they can be just as happy as possible because, you know, Dorothy has saved them.
I remember another horrifying scene is where the monkey, the flying monkeys, tear Scarecrow apart limb from limb, literally. So he's just a bunch of scattered straw, and he's just a head talking, but he's still somehow alive. And I remember being rather bothered by that when I was a kid because he was just all ripped to shreds. I was, you know, and whether intentional or not, my inner concordance of movies was going off, and I'm recognizing all these things that kind of seem to later find their way into movies.
Right.
So you have the epic quest thing, which, you know, how many times have we seen that? The movie Chef. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
You know,
it's the whole Odyssey thing.
This is literally a road movie.
Yeah, a literal road movie. I saw lots of Lord of the Rings, you know, the stuff the flying monkeys and the orcs were not that far apart from right, my right. point of view, or the witch and what was his name? Sardon?
Sauron. Yeah.
Sauron and the whole Mordor thing. And also the balloon scene when she's supposed to go back to Kansas in the balloon, but the balloon gets away. It kind of reminded me of that scene in Munchausen. You know,
right,
out-of-control
yes.
balloon. And,
yep.
and it's like, I'm starting to wonder, do people like just intentionally throw in Wizard of Oz scenes as just kind of homage? You know, it's almost required to have something of the Wizard of Oz in your movie.
Citizen Kane often like gets the top billing for like the best movie. You know, if you have any list of like the 100 best movies of the last century or whatever, but the Wizard of Oz is probably one of the most influential, if not at the top of that list, because like you're saying, it does have all of this impact on so many things. It's also, it is a fantasy film, you know, in a lot of ways. It has in it this, like we talked about, when we were talking about The Witch, we talked about how it didn't really provide the audience an out, right? Like it didn't give you a modernist or postmodernist escape hatch. Mm-hmm. And this does, because she got hit in the head. And maybe this is all just happening in her head.
Yeah, the old dream thing. Who? What else does? What other movies do that? Where the movie turns out not to be, not to be real. Although, well, maybe
one
it
of the
is.
Was it one of the famous ones in pop culture is that show Dallas. Where one of the characters wakes up, and
I loved that series.
And it's like,
I was hooked on that series.
Like the whole past season was a dream. Like,
yeah,
it was
that's
JR
right.
yeah, being shot,
wakes up from the coma or whatever,
right?
And the whole season didn't happen.
Or there's that TV show Newhart, where you know at the very end of it, Bob Newhart wakes up and he, you know, he's in bed and he turns over and he says, "I had the craziest dream," and it's his wife from the previous sitcom he did before the sitcom that we were all just watching for 5 or 6 years or whatever. So like Suzanne Plachet is it, like, you know, like that kind of thing. So yeah, there are these moments where you get like the whole, like, it was just all a dream. And of course it all kind of fits into this sort of dream like stuff. We have a little clip here that kind of puts a bunch of that stuff together, and we'll talk more about it on the other side.
How's she coming? Take it easy. Oh, you got my finger.
Why don't you get your finger out of the way?
There you are. Right on my finger.
It's a lucky thing it wasn't your head.
Zeke, what am I going to do about Miss Gus just because Toto chases her old cat?
Listen, honey, I got them hogs to get in.
Now look at Dorothy, you ain't using your head about Miss Gulch. Think you didn't have any brains at all.
I have so got brains.
Well, why don't you use them? When you come home, don't go by Miss Gulch's place. Then Toto won't get in her garden, and you won't get in no trouble, see?
Oh, Hunk, you just won't listen, that's all.
Well, your head ain't made of straw, you know.
Oh, you're the best friends anybody ever had. And it's funny, but I feel as if I've known you all the time. But I couldn't have, could I?
I don't see how. You weren't around when I was stuffed and sewn together, were you?
And I was standing over there rusting for the longest time.
Still, I wish I could remember. But I guess it doesn't matter anyway. We know each other now, don't we?
That's right.
We do.
To Oz?
To Oz.
There, lie quiet now. You just had a bad dream.
Sure. Remember me?
Your old pal, Hunk?
Oh. Me? Hickory? You couldn't forget my face, could you?
But it wasn't a dream. It was a place. And you, and you, and you... And you were there.
Oh, sure.
But you couldn't have been, could you?
Oh, we dream lots of silly things when we...
No, Aunt Em. This was a real, truly live place. And I remember that some of it wasn't very nice, but most of it was beautiful. But just the same, all I kept saying to everybody was, I want to go home. And they sent me home. Doesn't anybody believe me?
Of course we believe you, though.
Oh, but anyway, Toto, we're home.
Toto believes her.
Of course we believe you. But this is, I think this was the most interesting thing, was I watching it again this time. That moment where she has she's on the edge of a lucid dream. She's like, I feel like I've known you guys but that couldn't possibly be the case. Mm-hmm. And like, this is the, I don't know if you've ever had like lucid dreams, but that's where in the dream you realize that it's a dream, and it's all, it suddenly unlocks a bunch of things, and you can do things you wouldn't normally do if you weren't unaware of the fact that you were dreaming.
Ted, we don't want to be talking about my dreams, but yeah, right. I know exactly what you're talking about though. And when they're good, I like to run with it. When they're bad, and frequently I have horrifying dreams. It used to disturb me, but now I just kind of view it as like the Rocky Horror Picture Show going off right, in my right. head. But somewhere in the dreamscape, I can convince myself this is going off in your head. It's not real. And then I want to continue that too, even though it's bad, you know, because I know it's not real. But I know what you mean, and I think that's a subtle thing in what is generally not a very subtle movie.
Yeah,
but that little moment where she's on the it's a moment of liminality, right? She's in Oz, but there's something outside of Oz that she's aware of, and I like that. I think that's kind of part of the charm of the movie.
Yeah, and I like. There's even been like comedy sketches and stuff about how like, you know, had she known that all she had to do is click her heels together three times. And then she could go home, that, you know, none of it would have happened, but that would have required being like to know what was going on, right? And the good witch doesn't tell her until the end, so Glinda doesn't tell her to the end, and the comedy sketch is usually like, you're a jerk, like why didn't you tell me right at the beginning, right? Like they let her have this big journey, but she, and the answer is, well, you wouldn't have believed me if I told you then.
Well, and not only that, but it fits that theme of the journey reveals things in you that you didn't know. See, right. It's like in Lord of the Rings, where you can't really go back because you've been through so much.
Right, right.
But it revealed a courage, a heroism, or whatnot in the hobbits that they didn't know was there. And it changed them. And so it's like when the wizard sends them off to get the broomstick, they have to do this. And in doing that, then they discovered courage, heart, and smarts.
Right. And in the same way with like Gandalf knew that they had all of that stuff in them in the Lord of the Rings films, like in Tolkien's book. He kind of brought them along because he knew they had it in them. And in the same sort of way, these characters that come along with Dorothy, they already had it all in them to start with.
Yeah, and I don't take this as sort of a new agey kind of the answer lies within kind of thing.
Right, right.
More than, you know, it's like we are born with innate abilities. We're not a tabula rasa.
Right, right.
Necessarily. Now we acquire knowledge from the outside, but we also acquire experience, where experience is kind of a strange thing, because it's not just simply, like we say, it's not just textbook learning or something. You don't right, get experience right, right. in the classroom. You get experience doing the thing. And in doing the thing, the doing changes you, or the doing reveals things you didn't know you could do.
Right.
And that's kind of, I think, what the underlying, if there's an inspirational aspect to the movie, it's doing that, is that our experiences, you know, shape us, so that whether it's a dream or whether it was real, and it doesn't matter, does it? And you know, that's not really totally answered. Dorothy is changed by the experience.
Mm-hmm.
See, and she's able to receive the people around her who love her in a different way, because she's gone through this experience.
I think there's probably like university dissertations written on the Jungian quality of like,
yeah, there you go,
the dreams and whatever, like to really dig into all of that too.
I like that the lion sounds like he's about to dole out a pastrami sandwich in a Jewish deli in New York.
Right. So
Hollywood. I mean, it's so 40s Hollywood, right?
Oh, yeah. Our mutual friend, Rudy, would really be upset with us if we didn't cover this next very important, bizarre element of The Wizard of Oz. Now, back when the internet was not new, because it was part of the military-industrial complex, but when it was new to people in the general public, suddenly some weird thing kind of cropped up. There had been this peculiarity that had developed along the way. And I don't know which stoner was the first to do it, but basically Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon could be synced up with The Wizard of Oz. You just had to wait for a certain moment. Like, you had to, like, the lion had to roar the third time in the MGM, like, little logo at the beginning of the film. And then you hit play on the Dark Side of the Moon. And then the there was a whole new experience.
Who so figured now, this out?
Like I said, I don't know which stoner figured this out, but for me,
wow.
I remember coming across this on the interwebs, and I, you know, went out and rented a copy, VHS copy of The Wizard of Oz, got my Dark Side of the Moon out.
You did it?
And I did it, and I watched it years ago in the 90s when this was first a thing. So we have a little clip, and now because it's of how this works, right? So what, Bill, you're going to have to describe to everybody what we see.
Okay.
Because we're going to hear a little bit of...
we're going to hear Pink Floyd.
Here we go.
All right, so...
This is a portion of the film. Just a little taste.
So this is the tornado scene.
Oh, yep.
House spinning, people going by in the window.
The witch foreshadowed.
She's by the window, yeah.
Yes.
Dorothy in the bed spinning, and the house in the clouds.
Yes, this is after she's hit her head, by the way, but yes.
That apparently was considered a major special effect in the day.
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually a fairly convincing tornado.
So now the house has landed.
Yeah. So we'll just see how this kind of, like...
I'm kind of feeling like Mystery Science 3000.
Yeah, well, for sure. This is the thing. Okay, so she's
looking around the house and trying to figure out exactly what's going on and where she is.
And this is the big moment.
Yeah, so opens the door and... color.
Yes.
Color. Dale Chihuly. Glass.
So there we go.
She's actually on the Yellow Brick Road, but she's exploring Munchkin Land here, and
yeah. So, you know, money.
Now I'm gonna have to find that. That's good.
Yes, it is something else, and there's a bunch of little things that line up in very interesting spots, and to the point where there was the internet kind of like, I don't know, folktale legend or whatever, or rumor that maybe they wrote Dark Side of the Moon.
Of course.
In like thinking of this movie to do this very thing.
Of course.
But of course that's not likely. I mean, and the guys from Pink Floyd have said, no, we didn't do that. But it is really interesting, the synchronicity of how that all like lines up and some stuff. And of course, the other kind of weird thing is that, you know, it's that song Money off of the album. And it is, like you said, the Yellow Brick Road. And in the book, it's not Ruby Slippers, it's Silver Slippers.
Mm.
So there's a way of looking at the book as an economic allegory for what was going on in the economy of the late 1890s and the beginning of the 1900s, and that, you know, the silver slippers are like silver and gold is like gold in the market and all of this kind of stuff. So there's a lot of people have had a lot of time to think a lot of things about about this film and about the stories and about the book, etc.
You have to have a lot of time and a lot of drugs to really go down that way. But, you know, yeah, you know, they did that with Beatles albums too. So,
yes.
I'm not surprised. That's priceless. That's really, really good.
And it's worthwhile doing it. It's a fun thing to do. Like, I remember like doing it in person. It was fun back in the day. So anyways, and do you have any parting final thoughts about The Wizard of Oz?
It was a delight to watch this film again, especially I think after having seen so many films in the context of Bill and Ted, you know, because I've been forced to pay more attention, and I'm collecting more and more movie things in my head. So you go back to one of the films from, you know, really kind of a, it's a really significant part in filmmaking.
Sure.
A time. And you kind of like, you just see things that I wouldn't have seen when I was a kid. It's been a long time, probably 20 or 30 years since I've watched that movie. And so, yeah, it was fun. And it got to me at an adult level. It's fun to sing along, you know, all the stuff. But then, as you said, as we pointed out, you see certain things that only an adult pair of eyes would pick up on. And the movie rewards you for that.
Yeah, and it's a peculiar story when you really think about it. It's like two women fighting over a pair of shoes.
I can't top that line.
We had a lot of fun watching it too. Okay, so life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around every once in a while, you could miss it. Our next film will be John Hughes's 1986 film Ferris Bueller's Day Off, starring Matthew Broderick as Ferris Bueller, a wisecracking Chicago teen who just wants a day off from the drudgery of high school life, with Alan Ruck, Mia Sara, Jennifer Grey, Jeffrey Jones, Edie McClurg, Ben Stein, can I get a Bueller, and even Charlie Sheen as Boy in Police Station. This fun screwball comedy beat out another decidedly more serious John Hughes film, teen film, The Breakfast Club from 1985.
Oh, that's a good movie.
Also a great movie in our Facebook poll, so that'll be our next film.
Excellent. Looking forward to it. And that'll notch off another film from the Bill and Ted mashup in the beginning.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I think we only have a few left in that, but we should probably put it on our to-do list to
eventually, yeah, we'll get around
out,
to all of
round
them,
out
yeah.
all the films in the mashup. Speaking of, you can follow us on Facebook, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, any of your favorite podcast players. Visit our website, BillAndTedMovies.com, for the full body of our work. We're up to 60 episodes with this one. And you can email us with your adventures on the Yellow Brick Road at BillAndTedWatchMovies@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and for watching movies along with us. Till next time, be excellent, Ted.
Party on, Bill.